If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
Too many people hire people that they're smarter than. I think that's a huge mistake. I mean, I think I'm a reasonably smart guy, but there's always people that are way smarter than me out there, and I look to bring them on my team in whatever way I can.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Mark has over 18 years of experience in real estate, totaling $3 billion plus in projects. With specific real estate expertise in development, financial analysis, and investment, Mark has a master's degree in science and real estate finance from New York University and a master's in science and management information system development from the George Washington University, and gives back by teaching real estate development and advanced financial analysis as a professor at NYU's Institute of Real Estate. Mark was formerly CEO at Massia Development from 2006 until it was sold in 2020. He's also worked as VP of Development at Archstone Smith, Residential, and Avalon Bay. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hey, man, that's a long resume and a lot of education. Suddenly, I feel very unqualified to do this interview. You know, but I do appreciate you coming on. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on this show is, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah, I did a very strange path. I had a master's degree in my undergrad. I did a five-year program. So I started with a lot of school. Apparently, I like spending money on education. And so started there. And while I was doing my master's there, I got a job with a family office doing development, which was kind of always what I dreamed of doing, but had no idea how to get into it. So my very first job was kind of an entrepreneurial venture with a family office. That was very, basically the dream come true job. So I started doing, my first project was $50 million multifamily development in the DC metro area, and kind of just built from there. So started working at larger and larger companies. Archstone, as you mentioned, which was formerly a Fortune 500 publicly traded REIT that was acquired by Equity Residential and Avalon Bay and split into two. I was there doing $500 million projects in New York City at the end. So, you know, really from a scaling up standpoint, my career was working for other people scaling up, and then quit, as you mentioned, started my own company a little over 12 years ago, I think, and kind of started over again. And at that time, built that company, scaled that company, sold that company last year, and started two new companies this year. So, or the last couple of years, I guess. But yeah, so keep going.
Man, that's awesome. I mean, it sounded like one of your keys was just getting an amazing, really first job out of school, doing some humongous projects.
Yeah. I mean, it was something I had no business doing at all, which is part of why the education came to be. I mean, the NYU was kind of proof to myself, hey, I actually do know what I'm talking about, not just I've done it. So that was kind of the backfill there.
Right. So you out of the gate, you started working on a $50 million multifamily development project. I'm sure that was like drinking from a fire hose.
Yeah, it's probably like looking back at one of the best times of my life, because yeah, you go from knowing nothing to being like, I'm in charge of everything. What's going on?
Wow. That's really cool. What are some things that you feel like you gleaned in that period that other people would do well to learn early on?
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about that from the past episodes years. I think there's a lot of arrogance in the market in multifamily investment or just real estate investment in general. And I think people think it's confidence. And what I mean by that is it's overconfidence and they just don't know the places they're not supposed to be as confident, because confidence really has been, you know, pivotal to my whole success. I mean, confidence is the only thing that got me through really that $50 million project, my first one, when I knew nothing. But what I did to make it confidence, not arrogance, in my opinion, was backfilling it with 10, 20 people that knew way more than I would probably still now don't know, and had them essentially mentor me in an informal way and hired them and worked around with them so that I could get it done. Because obviously I knew there were huge gaps in my knowledge base. I think that's really lacking in the industry overall. And I find that to be really concerning, because it feels like, you know, people think they know more than they do, and they're going to get blindsided or have been blindsided by things. And obviously, like, I'm not perfect. I've done the same thing. I've made tons of mistakes as well, but I try to mitigate the impact or the magnitude of those as much as possible, mainly by just surrounding myself with really smart people that are more experienced and better than me.
Yeah. I mean, I love that. I love that. Yeah. Because I mean, for you, especially starting out, you had no option but to go to people smart than you and say, hey, what am I doing here? Like, how does this work?
Yep.
So that's fantastic. And so you work for that family office for how many years?
So I was I mean, I technically worked with them until last year because they were a large investor in our funds and whatnot. But I was only there for 3 years building those projects with them. And then I transitioned to a larger company that was backed by Lehman Brothers and some other things. So.
Gotcha. Okay. So then you were CEO at Massia Development from 06 to 2020. You sold your company last year. What did Massia Development do?
Yeah, so it started out as a development company, hence the name. And part of the reason I kind of divested and moved on was because it really morphed into a family office investment vehicle. So I worked with sort of five large family offices that, you know, were multi-billion dollar families. And, you know, we had small investors. We had 500 individual active smaller investors, just high net worth individuals. But it really was directed mainly by those five families. And, you know, they were pushing their agenda of what they wanted for their portfolio and their sort of wealth didn't really align in the end with what I was hoping to accomplish. They were less involved in development. They were less involved in multifamily. It was much more retail and other asset class, medical office, things like that. So, you know, it's a great experience. And I, you know, have nothing bad to say about that experience overall and the people I worked with. But it wasn't really where my heart was. My heart has always been in development. And so that kind of was the pivot. We said, all right, let's divest of that and let them run it the way they want to run it. And then we'll start over in the development world where we really want it to be.
Right. Now, that's really interesting. I mean, was that a hard decision?
Yeah, I mean, obviously my name was on the company, so one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. And, you know, there's a lot of emotion tied to that amount of wealth on the other side. So it was not like an easy transition. I think in the end it became amicable, but, you know, there were some really tense conversations over a period of years that, you know, made that tough. But yeah, it all worked out in the end, and, you know, I'm very happy and they're very happy. And so I think it worked out.
Right. What are some things as you rewind the tape, I guess, from 2020 to 2006 that you feel like you guys really did right?
I mean, same exact thing that I mentioned at the outset. Like, we got involved in a lot of things that we had no idea what we were doing for the families. So when we started working with some of these larger individuals or families that we worked with, you know, I had never placed $100 million on my own into a diverse set of assets across the country. And that was really essentially what we were tasked with doing. And so I had to really quickly, you know, find people that could work with me in my company and also like consultants and other people. And so it was the same thing. So the confidence was, I knew I could figure it out. I knew I could solve a hard problem. And that was a really hard problem. And that's really what development and really entrepreneurship is all about, right? It's just solving problems. But I also knew that I didn't have all the answers and I needed to find people to surround myself with. So we found great lawyers, great architects, great, you know, brokers, great in-house people, great asset managers. And I just basically kept like assembling as many of those people as I could humanly, you know, muster and afford to make that work. And I think that was really the key, is believing in myself, that confidence in myself, which, you know, can border on arrogance to a degree in the sense that I didn't have any experience doing it before, but I knew that if I would surround myself with people that had done it before, so it wasn't just kind of coming out of thin air.
Right. What were some challenges that you guys faced placing those larger amounts of money?
Yeah, I mean, tons, right? I mean, the market changed so much between, you know, the 2009 financial crisis and everything else. So, I mean, we started out doing much more multifamily and student housing in the urban markets like New York, DC, and Boston. And then we transitioned out of that into more stable, you know, triple net lease kind of assets nationwide and did some student housing. I mean, there were all kinds of pivots along the way based on the way the market was going. And to be perfectly honest, like we were concerned early on about the cap rates on the multifamily secondary market. So we got out of the buying stabilized multifamily, you know, probably way earlier than we should have just based on our fear of past events. But that kind of was one of those things where just a bad call, but had no idea that, you know, cap rates and interest rates would be where they are today. So it was kind of hard to predict.
Yeah. You know, as everybody always says, their crystal balls is not working. So
yeah.
And that's it. I mean, you have to make decisions based upon the information you have at the time.
Yep, absolutely.
And, you know, kudos to you for getting out with your shirt on. You know, I'm sure you came out just fine. And there's a lot of people that are on the other end of that, you know, scenario that are going, crap, I wish I had made that decision sooner. So, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a give and take. I mean, I think certainly we could have done more deals and placed more capital had we been less afraid of losing money. But my, you know, number one mantra was always the Warren Buffett, you know, rule number one, don't lose any money. And we were fortunate enough that really only one deal we ever did in the last, whatever, it's been 14 years, lost any money. And that money was recouped future deals that we did with those people. So it didn't, you know, it could have been worse, much worse, you know, in that respect.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you guys started in 06 and then weathered the 08, 09, you know, crisis and only lost money on one deal, then you were doing something right. So that's
we were very careful. Let's say that.
right. Yeah, absolutely. So when you guys go out and place capital, you guys were actually buying the asset, operating it yourself, doing the whole nine yards.
Correct. Yeah. We worked with outside consultants for leasing and property management in markets where we didn't have a foothold. But yeah, I mean, exactly. We did everything in-house.
Otherwise, you were building out property management. You were doing it in for you. And do you think that having the capital backing that you had was one of the things that really helped kind of scale your company?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. We couldn't have done what we had done without the multifamily offices that we were working with. You know, their capital just afforded us the ability to do things. But, you know, honestly, friends of mine who have similar companies have done it with, you know, just a larger pool of investors. So there are plenty of ways to skin that cat. I just happened to be fortunate enough to have worked with that one family and kind of, you know, built upon that one family relationship to build other family relationships and build the trust so that, you know, that worked for us. That was a competitive advantage for us. But, you know, mainly because I had other friends who were, you know, whose families were super wealthy. And so they were like, oh, my dad just wrote a $10 million check and now I'm doing deals. And I'm like, damn, I wish I had that, you know? So.
right. Now that's super cool. So what was it like selling your company in 2020? I mean, when did you sold any time in 2020, I guess, would be an interesting time to have sold a real estate company.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been a lot easier if we had worked a little faster because we actually started the deal in 2019. Then obviously, you know, March, April, May, kind of, we didn't finish transaction until around July. And so it definitely was a little dicey. But luckily, since it was mostly medical office and retail, those spaces had medical has been doing really well throughout and retail had kind of taken its lumps for the last few years anyway. So it wasn't that drastically different. Most of the tenant base that we had weathered the storm relatively well. So it wasn't like, you know, we had mass exodus of like movie theaters or some crazy use that just, you know, was decimated.
Right. Now that's super cool. So what does business look like for you today?
Yeah. So we're focusing exclusively on development. We have two companies, Drive Through Development and Urban Phoenix. And we essentially do residential development in the Urban Phoenix, multifamily residential infill development. And we do retail development with Drive Through Development. So essentially build to suit kind of whether it's, you know, national franchisees or other individual uses that have drive-thrus. So.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. So you said you're building in Phoenix then?
Yeah. So Urban Phoenix is based in Phoenix where my partner and I started the company where I was previously living up until the beginning of this year. But yeah, so that's a great market. Always wanted to be there. I've been living there for a long time and started that company specifically to develop multifamily assets in that market.
Gotcha. Now that's super cool. So what does that look like for you guys? I mean, how do you walk us through that process of development? You know, I don't bring a lot of developers on here.
Sure.
So actually I think of about five, maybe tops that have come on in the last 200 episodes. So walk us through the development process for you guys. Like, how do you find the land? How do you find, you know, what does market study look like? Walk me through kind of what you think when you think of development, what does that mean to you?
Sure. Yeah, we're urban infill type development, so we're really focusing less on greenfield, kind of open dirt. So that's a totally different world and not really something I've ever really done that much of. So not my focus. Not to say it's good or bad, just not what we do. And so, you know, our stuff is never really like a patch of dirt and you're like, let me build something there. It's almost always a small underutilized building or parking lot or some kind of other use that, you know, can be used as a higher and better use. So first we're looking at like kind of the overlay, the zoning overlay. So there's basically every city has kind of their plan. Usually it's a 10-year plan and they overlay and say, okay, this area currently is industrial, but we want it to be medical or this area, you know, whatever it is, their whole overarching plan. You start with that and that helps kind of identify the areas of where they're heading. And that will help you develop, because it develops a long game. It's like, you know, to do a development deal, it's 24 to 36 months on average. So it's not like I'm just getting in there and be like, I'm going to buy it tomorrow and just close in 30 or 60 days. There's a huge long lag time for that part of it. And so the first start is look at that map, figure out the markets we want to be in, like within that map. And then, you know, really just pepper, just like any, you know, house flipper or anybody, right? Just pepper every single place that meets the criteria and see what we can get, whether it's on market, off market, do a yield study from there just to see what you can build. And then the rest is somewhat similar to just a general multifamily acquisition where we're, you know, analyzing what current market rents are, what we think we can get, escalating that based on, you know, the market being 2 to 3 years out from when we're actually doing lease up, that kind of thing. So yeah, I think the upfront stuff's a little more difficult because you can't just underwrite the NOI. There is no NOI. You have to predict what the NOI will be based on income and expenses of today and escalation. And you have to do the same with construction costs. So, you know, so there's a little bit more of a crystal ball kind of challenge that you were referring to earlier, but that's kind of what makes it fun for us. So.
Right, right. No, that's fascinating. Doing an infill would be a very interesting thing to do. And I think your idea of going to city planning and seeing what the city plan is.
Yeah.
You know, where they see things moving, where are things getting zoned?
Yep.
And what can we buy inside of that that makes sense? And I think the other cool thing with that is you're not bringing utilities to those sites. I mean, that's got to be a huge expense as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it depends on the market. I mean, you know, sometimes there is utilities that are fully usable. Sometimes you have to upscale them. Like a lot of times in the urban environments, they want you to underground the above ground power lines, and that can be hugely expensive. So, you know, give and take, there's pros and cons. Sometimes they're dirtier sites in the cities because they used to be like some, you know, car wash or who knows what. But yeah, in general, it's just what I know and understand better, you know, so it just fits. So.
No, that's great. That's great, man. Yeah. I mean, you stay within what you know. What are some risks you see in development that kind of, not things maybe that keep you up at night, but what are some things that you try to actively mitigate in the planning process?
Yeah. I mean, literally everything we do is risk mitigation and working towards that. I mean, because everything's uncertain, right? With an existing asset, you can touch it, you can feel it, you can inspect it, you can, you know, see, meet the tenants. You can do all kinds of things that make you have a level of certainty that we just are not capable of doing. I mean, we don't know who the end user is going to be until 12 to 24 to 36 months out down. Same with zoning, same with everything. So, you know, really like the upfront analysis and the kind of research on the due diligence side is a huge, you know, part of what we do. We have to know, you know, what the zoning, where the zoning is going. So like, you know, meet the council members, do the things and say, will this project likely get approved? All well in advance of actually, you know, investing real dollars in the land. So we may spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in research, whether it's through consultants or lobbyists or whomever, before we even spend a dollar on the deposit, like burn a dollar on the deposit of the land and things. So ours is a much more kind of front-loaded heavy research that we hope in the long run pays off, because once the land is purchased and everything else, you know, you're a lot more invested in the project taking place. So yeah, I'd say upfront, just kind of research.
Right, right. Making sure you get that done right. What does it look like, or how do you tie up the property such that, you know, you're going to do all this research, right? But you don't want to, like, and as you said, not until you know that the city council is going to approve, or whoever it is, zoning and planning, they're going to approve the project. How do you tie that asset up so that when you do get approved, you know, it's not already turned into a gas station or something else behind your back?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So there's three kind of main ways. One is just the true option, where the land seller understands that the best use is not existing today, and they will give you the time. So basically just say, instead of a traditional seller in the market saying, oh, I need a 30-day due diligence, 30-day close or something like that, they get it. They're like, oh, this is going to take time. And so until you get your approvals, you know, no money is hard. Just put a deposit, have a agreed contract, whatever. And that's probably the most typical, especially if it's a marketed deal, that's the way it's going to go. Some of these off-market transactions, if we find something that's just priced amazingly well, you know, we'll close on it and use it as it is. So sometimes it's a parking lot, sometimes it's a, you know, single-story business or whatever, a single-family home, you know, whatever it may be, and just kind of, you know, deal with the negative cash flow or whatever in the meantime, because it's not that, it's nominal and the price is so great. But the other option would be, you know, some sort of combination of the two, where you either, you know, give them some sort of option payments along the way, almost like a rental payment that give you the time you need, but doesn't require you to put down the full purchase price day one. Those are probably the three main ways. I mean, obviously there's a million ways, but those are kind of the three main ways we use.
Right. 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 Just so you can protect, you know, your investment. If you're investing hundreds of thousands of dollars in research, you want to make sure that the project then can carry forward, you know, once.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly. Right. Right. That's interesting. How has your development plans changed, especially, and you guys are building multifamily, but how has that changed in the post-COVID environment?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of a big contrarian in general, so I don't see that much of a lasting change. I mean, I saw financing dry up when we were trying to do projects in the last 12 months, so that changed, but not by my choice. In general, I mean, I think we're looking at a lot more like townhome development, so sort of rather than go vertical with the urban development, some of it's more segregated because of the common corridors being less attractive to some people. So, you know, we've looked at more of those deals. We've done more of those deals because it's still multifamily, but it's horizontal, and it's still urban because it's not single family detached, it's attached. So we've looked at them, and we're doing a couple more of those deals than we probably would have without COVID, if I'm being perfectly honest. But in general, like, we're not, like, you know, we're not building huge Zoom rooms and whatever else people are doing. That's not part of our program.
Right, right. No, understood. Understood. Yeah, that, you know, hopefully the weirdness goes away soon. What about, you know, today is, we're recording this on May 12th. So lumber prices right now are insane, right?
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Oh boy, yeah.
So yeah, it's just sound like I'm touching on a pain point. What are you guys doing? I mean, are you guys hedging with futures or what, how are you guys, you know, absorbing that as you build?
Yeah, it's brutal because it started in lumber, which, you know, is less of what we do because we do a lot of like H steel or concrete in our larger structures, you know, going vertical. And so, you know, we're like, great, stay in lumber and we don't really care as much. And then it quickly kind of spread to everything. And so, yeah, it's been brutal. It's been tough. And no, we aren't. I mean, our contractors are pretty large and sophisticated and been very good partners with us and helping us stay abreast of what's going on. But yeah, we haven't utilized, you know, higher level functions through futures and whatever contracts recently. I mean, luckily interest rates are still relatively bailing us out in the sense that, you know, a lot of these deals we performed at 12, 18 months ago had higher interest rates than we are today. So that's helpful to some degree. And the same thing with cap rates, right? I mean, we were, you know, some of the stuff that we're seeing, especially in Phoenix, you know, it's just not, it's helpful. So we'll see. So far it's working out, but yeah, we're tracking it. I mean, obviously it's the biggest pain point we have right now.
Right, right. Yeah, no, that's interesting that those are two interesting points, that cap rate compression obviously helps kind of absorb some of that, you know, higher cost to build. Yeah, that's, I forget the other one you just said. But you tell me a second one there.
Almost interest rates, yes, but they're tied together, obviously.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So your cost to borrow goes down. Either way, you know, it's still not fun. Like, because then you're...
No. It's not going to me. So we're making more money on one side, but we're losing it to the material side. So yeah, not helping. Yeah.
Not helping. Right. Yeah. I mean, because if the lumber and materials prices were lower, then you would did that would just be more money in your pocket. So...
Exactly.
That's unfortunate. Man, Mark, you guys are doing awesome things. I want to hear quickly what the other side of the company does. You told me you're doing retail development as well, drive-through retail. So is this like Walgreens you're building or what? Like when you say that, what does that mean?
Exactly. So any kind of single tenant or like build-to-suit multi-tenant space that, you know, so we do a lot of T-Mobile work. We do a lot of KFC work. We do a lot of Starbucks and Jimmy John's and things like that. So just places that have a need for expansion across, you know, multiple markets and multiple locations. Those deals are a lot quicker. They're, you know, 6 to 12 months in development pipeline instead of, you know, 24 to 36 or whatever on a multifamily side. So it's just a way of keeping both. I have a significant background in the multifamily side. That's really where my expertise lies. And my partner is much more on the retail development side. So it was a great fit to just sort of say, okay, like, yeah, you know more about this and whatever I don't know, you'll fill in and vice versa. So that's why we separated, and it just became too confusing to do it under one umbrella. So we have two separate companies, even though it's technically, you know, just the same partners.
Right. Understood. And I would think that when you're building those build to suit projects, I mean, there's little risk for you as the builder. That's much more on the current owner of the land that's hiring you guys to build it. Or are you guys buying the land, developing it, and then selling it?
We do both technically. Pretty much everybody does the latter of what you said, that sort of at-risk development in our in that space. And so we've tried to carve out a niche for ourselves that is more on the kind of fee development side, where someone says, hey, I've got this land and I got the tenant, but I don't know how to develop it. Or, you know, more recently, it's been more franchisee driven. Like we have some of the largest like franchisees in the country that, you know, have 70, 80, 100 plus locations. And a lot of them are leased and they want to own, transition to more ownership of their real estate because they're creating all this value for someone else. They want to create it for themselves. And so they come to us and say, hey, we want to open 10 more, you know, whatever, KFCs. And we say, okay, or Taco Bells, you know, whatever. And we'll do all the work for them. They get to own the end asset and we just get the fee and kind of wipe our hands and move on to the next 9 sites that we do with them.
Right. Man, that's super cool. That's super cool. Mark, I appreciate your time today. This was certainly fascinating. You guys are doing awesome things. And I just look forward to seeing where you guys go in the future. Let's wrap up here with the final four. The first question is this: what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Yeah, I think, like I said, it's just whether they're formal mentors or in general, just team surrounding yourself. I mean, always be looking for your blind spot and filling in with someone who knows more than you. Like, too many people hire people that they're smarter than. I think that's a huge mistake. I mean, I think I'm a reasonably smart guy, but there's always people that are way smarter than me out there. And I look to bring them on my team in whatever way I can.
Right. No, that's awesome. Question number two is this: when it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
Yeah. So here I'm going to go kind of a weird way to some degree and go mental health. You know, I spent a long time reading books and other self-help things and business health, but I never really spent time on kind of my own personal mental health. And, you know, recently I've been working with a therapist pretty much every week for the last 2 years, and it's been probably the best thing I've ever done in my life. It's just kind of freed me up in many different ways, personally and professionally. And, you know, hopefully I'll do it for the rest of my life. It's been amazing.
That's awesome. Good for you. That's fantastic. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
Yeah, teaching and mentoring. I mean, that's why I do NYU. I mean, there's no money in that at all. Teaching there, even though it's a great prestigious school, they pay nothing. But so I do that and I enjoy that. And then mentoring younger investors and developers in any way I can. I love to help people and, you know, help them avoid the mistakes that I made if I can.
Right, right. That's great. Mark, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Probably email, just MM, my initials, drivethrough.dev. It's the shortest, easiest email, I think.
That's awesome. Mark, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.